First of all, let me introduce myself to you. I'm Gary Sowers, and I'm an optometrist, and I live in Orlando, Florida. I say Orlando. I practice in Orlando, Florida, and I live in Maitland, Florida, which is a little suburb. I became a Christian when I was 13 years old in a Methodist church in Pennsylvania. Come on in. Let me give you a little background to that. Come on in, join us. Take one of each of those. Would you give at least this one to the new folks that just came in? That's my outline. When I was 8 years old, I went and received a pair of glasses to help me with my vision. And at that point in time, it was so dramatic to me to be able to see visually that I decided to become an optometrist. 9 years old, I got a catalog from the school in Philadelphia that I eventually attended. And then I moved through life with some direction and probably a more mature outlook on life than a lot of kids my age. But as I did that, I used to go to sleep at night with a recurring burden to my heart. I had already decided I was going to be an optometrist. I felt like that someday I'd meet somebody like Mom and I'd get married and then I'd have a family and then I'd practice and be happy and prosperous and I'd grow old in the profession and I'd retire and go to Florida and and then I would die. And that really bothered me, the fact that I was going to die, and there was no answer to that. And I was carried to church from the time I was born and faithfully attended, got all the little banners and ribbons. But it wasn't until I was 13 and in a junior high school class with a man teacher where he described what Jesus Christ had done for me personally and for each of us. That morning, there were about 10 of us young fellows there, and he described the gospel of grace and Jesus Christ's death on the cross. And I recognized, well, I knew I had a need. I knew I wasn't a perfect child, but I had a need to have hope, and I had a need to be saved. I had a need to be put aside. And so that morning, I prayed to receive Christ. So for those of you who worry about your children and their walk with God, I went 20 years without any appreciable growth in my Christian life before I started to walk with God in 1969. So that is a background, a little bit to my life story. First of all, I want to tell you about this workshop. You all have a rough outline with 5 points on it. And then you have a series of discussion and meditation questions. This is in my one little outline I handed out. There's 5 of those, and they go along with the 5 points that I'd like to talk to you about this morning. Now, those discussion and meditation questions are for you to use as you will at home or with maybe a Bible study group or with your husband or wife or whatever the situation. They're basically designed to make you think about the things we're going to talk about this morning and to think about where you are in terms of raising children. And then there's a book list, books that have been meaningful to me. Sometimes we read the positive books, the books that tell you exactly how to do everything. But one book I might point out, it's printed by InterVarsity Publications, is called Parents in Pain. And this deals with children that are gone astray, children that are doing things you don't appreciate, don't understand, don't know. And it's, I think, a different one to look at than most of the others. By John White, that one. So, as Gene Warr had assigned me this task, My first impression was to turn it down. He said we had that option. We could choose not to do a certain workshop, and you know, and he'd give us another assignment. But I've known Gene Warr for 15 years, and he's been a man who has encouraged me personally. As you can see, his exuberance up there on the stage. But at any rate, he's done that to me personally, and I figured he prayed about me as one to do this, and that probably God knew I needed to do it. And so I'm coming to you not as an expert. I'm coming to you as a layman, as a father, as a husband, as a son, as an optometrist, as somebody who's lived 50 years, and not going to try to tell you all how to do these things. I'm going to share some life experiences, some things for you to consider about your own parenting or about people you have to influence in that regard. It's too big to cover in an hour. If I just flashed place after place, verse after verse, principle after principle, you can do the same by reading these books. It's too enormous a subject. And so I've tried to simplify to a degree some of the things that have been important in our life in raising children. Perhaps this one's bothering you too. I have some loud colleagues. I have not met the two gentlemen that are doing this same workshop till we arrived here this weekend. So their handouts were available here. Make sure you get all of them before you leave. If you want to catch another one of their seminars later this morning or this afternoon, do so. I'm sure we're all treating this subject differently. But I want you to know that I'm not coming to you as an expert, somebody who's bragging about accomplishments or knowledge on the subject. I am coming to you as a Christian disciple and somebody who does care about our children and your children, and perhaps I can be of some help in adding to your armament of raising your kids. How many have children that you're raising right now in your homes that are here? Okay. So we have two that aren't. And you've done the task? You raised how many?
I raised two children. Now we're raising one grandchild.
One grandchild. Very good. You know why they're grand, right? It's a great name for
Grandpa Dad.
I didn't even think about that till we had our first grandchild, about why they're called grand. Just to fill you in on our picture, because that's what I have to talk about. That's my wife, Susie. She is a school teacher by education. She was not saved when we got married. I was saved, but pretty much unaware of Christianity beyond the knowledge of my salvation. I was a church goer, a church officer, a church leader, Sunday school teacher. My wife taught Sunday school from 1962 until she got saved in 1968. She taught 5-year-olds because they didn't threaten her. She knew how to handle 5-year-olds. God and Jesus Christ were scary to her, but 5-year-olds were not. And so rather than be scared in an adult Sunday school class, she decided to teach Sunday school to 5-year-olds. That was part living with me as a person who had a different heart, although I wasn't a mature Christian. Was part of her conversion, watching and reading the Sunday school material and watching the lives of 5-year-olds change was part of her conversion. And then a number of testimonies by professional scientists from NASA and other places in our area who had come to a saving knowledge of Christ through a simple faith in what they could not see were all part of her conversion. In 1968, she became a Christian, And in 1969, we started to walk together toward this path of spiritual multiplication that Billy talked to us about this morning. We have been fruitful in our lives. This is our extended family, and a little better. Apologize for the quality of these. Starting on the left is my son David, who's 19. He's our baby. The first girl coming across the left is our daughter Jean, who's 22. And behind her is her husband Tim, who is an engineer, a Georgia Tech graduate. They got married December of 1983. Coming across from left to right, the second girl is Louise, our middle daughter. She's 24, and she's married to an engineer, a graduate of Annapolis, who is a nuclear engineer in the Navy. And then our third daughter, oldest daughter, 26, is Kathy. She's married to Bernie, who has a Ph.D. in theology and teaches at a Catholic college in Bismarck, North Dakota. That's Rebecca, our grandchild. She's a year and a half and is a real grand, thrilling thing for my wife and for me. This was this past Christmas, and we assembled them all. It takes a miracle to bring them in from North Dakota. But that's our so far extended immediate family. And last but not least is our cat Stubbs. You can see why we call him Stubbs. He has, we don't know whether he's a Manx or whether he got caught in a door or whatever, but he was dropped off in our neighborhood, and the kids took him in, and he's become an integral part of our family. Especially my son. My son loves that cat. He picks him up when he gets home from work each day and has a great time with Stubbs. Why Stubbs takes the abuse that he takes, I'll never know. The first point that I want to talk about this morning, and again, I apologize. If you have a severe question, something that's bothering you, please stop me. I would like to cover these five points on your outline as quickly as possible, and then if there's time for a question. A workshop is meant to work in, and I know that, and I've given workshops before, but this particular area I have not tried to give. It's a large area, and if I have you sitting around half the time doing some work, I'm not sure that I can impart some of the things out of my heart that I'd like to. The first verse under time is Deuteronomy 6, 6, and 7. Do you know what a mezuzah is? Any of you? Sounds like a musical instrument, doesn't it? That's right. That's mezuzah. It's found on the right side of the door frame as you enter a Jewish person's house. Now, we do have one of those on our house door, by the way, and that gets a lot of questions. We have a shalom plaque on the back door and a mezuzah on the front door. We keep everybody, including the Jehovah's Witnesses, guessing. They don't guess very long when they come to our home. But at any rate, inside the mezuzah is found these verses. It's a kind of a combination little thing for the Jews. It's one to remind them of the Passover and putting the blood on the door so that the angel of death will go by. And it's another thing to remind them of their obligations to their children. And when you read those words inside that mezuzah, it says, "And these words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your sons, and you shall talk of them when you sit in the house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." And that pretty well sums up what I mean by time with your children. The key words in verse 7 are being diligent, and in all the descriptions of what you're doing with your children. Diligently, you're talking with them, teaching them, walking with them, lying down, rising up with them, and just literally doing everything, your whole life, sharing your life. And you're hearing that in the messages this weekend. If you listen in any Christ-centered message you hear anywhere, you'll hear this basic same message, that it's your life that you're living, and what you're saying and what you're doing that is going to make the difference to your children as far as imparting these principles. Now, I'll say this right outside. If you yourself do not have convictions, which is item number 4 in our list, if you do not have convictions about spiritual principles in your own life, it'll be very difficult for you to impart them to your children. And so, please don't rely on the church to teach your children spiritual principles. Yes, they help. Please don't rely on the school that they attend, say it's a Christian or parochial type school. Don't rely on that to teach them their spiritual principles. Yes, they help. Don't rely on somebody else to do the teaching and the training of spiritual principles. Please think of yourselves as the primary teacher and trainer. And you do not have to be gifted at teaching and training any more than you have to be gifted at evangelism to do evangelism. Now, some people are gifted at teaching some of these things, and they are in positions, generally speaking, like in church schools, in Christian teaching institutions, here and there, doing seminars. People are gifted in some of these things, but basically, you do not have to be supernaturally gifted, but you have to be supernaturally empowered, and that comes about, like Mr. Riggs said last night, by being drunk with the Holy Spirit, controlled by the Holy Spirit, and allowing Him to do this teaching in your life. I just kind of divide it all the time, anytime, all through life, and I'll go into that just a little bit, but we're not going to dwell on that too much. Let me show you one of my favorite cartoons for a moment. If you can't read it over there, the little guy says, "Dad, will you play ball with me?" And he says, "Now, ditto, I have 100 things to do." And he says, "Could I be 101st? And probably this is the most common, one of the most common things you run into in the raising of children is whether you're going to give them time. I can remember sitting back in my study when I became excited about growing as a Christian and studying my Bible, and one of the little kiddos would come in and want, you know, "Dad, Dad." And at more than once I said, you know, I'll do it. I'll talk to you in a little while. Can't you see I'm studying? There I am, studying God's Word and telling my kids to wait. Well, Lord got through to me after a while, and I ceased to do that. The biggest thing that I learned in all that type of an exercise was that, generally speaking, they do not require much time, especially when they're little. They're usually a one-word or one-hug answer, one little description, and they're back on the road again, and they're not bothering you anymore. But we're fearful because we have plans that the children are going to interrupt these plans and make it impossible for us to finish. In other words, the lack of trust in God. That's kind of the basic weakness. We do not trust God, and we simply think we won't get done if we stop and be the 101st, you know, with the little guy here. Our family does things together. When we vacation, normally speaking, we do it as a family. We don't anymore. The nest is emptying rapidly. A lot more rapid than it took to fill the nest. It's, you know, within a little over 2 years, all three of our daughters were married, and just like that, they're gone. We are excited about their relationships with their husbands. We feel good about that. We're encouraged. But nevertheless, it's an empty spot inside of you, and you'll hear a lot about the midlife crisis. I don't believe in a midlife crisis. I think some people in midlife go through crises. In fact, we go through crises at any age. Some we know about, some we don't. But a lot of the crisis that's present in our lives as the children grow up is a lack of planning for the next phase of our life. Our lives are seasonal. The big mission thrust in the next 10 to 20 years will be people like you and me going on the mission field as professionals, as doctors, lawyers, engineers, teachers, carpenters, electricians. And a lot of those people will be people like me who have turned their children loose to another family unit and are now more free to do these kind of things. There are presently 40-some doors that are closed to official missionaries in countries of the world. And this is taking about a very large percentage. I won't quote it because I don't want to be wrong, but it's a very large percentage of the people in the world are behind these doors that are closed to missionaries. These doors are not closed to physicists and doctors and teachers and all these other professional type people. And so we need to be thinking in those kind of terms and planning for what God will do for us and with us as these years go on. A lot of people plan through their raising their children and their educating their children and their job building to a certain crescendo in the occupation that they have, and they don't plan beyond that. They do not plan for this next season of their life. And when you get there without planning, it's a crisis. And you want to call it whatever you want, but we need to plan for what our next phase is. My wife and I are very busy praying and planning for the next phase of our life. We're excited, probably more excited than we've ever been in our life at our next plans. I'm seeking counsel. I've, in a multitude of counsel, there's safety. And I don't want to run off like a little kid and do something wild without some safety. So I'm presently doing that. But we, as a family, vacation as a family as long as we could. We waited till all of our children, till the last one, the first one was ready to leave high school before we took what I called a heritage trip through Washington, Williamsburg, Gettysburg, and all the historical things centered up there in that northeast area. I wanted to take them all together and see these things. I wanted the youngest to be as old as possible so that he would remember. And yet I wanted the oldest to be with us, and I didn't have to drag her back from summer school at college or do something. And so we took the opportunity at the spring break between my oldest girl's senior year in high school to do that trip. We worshiped together. I don't know if any of you have been annoyed by 10 teenagers sitting all together behind you in church. Eating candy and giggling and talking. And the parents of this one's over here and the parents of that one's over there, and they're kind of scattered around the church. Now, I have a little difficulty concentrating when that's going on, and we in our church have had to talk to some of the parents to try to stop those kind of things. But our children were aware that one of our rules was as long as they were at home, when we went to worship, we did it together. And, you know, the rule wasn't you got to totally pay attention, you've got to take notes, you've got to be able to apply this when you leave. Those were not the rules. The rules are we're going to do it together. And I'll address some of that issue as we go along. But we worship together. We do things at our home together. Driver's training, we took those opportunities to have one-on-one time with our children. I've been dating my children until they got married. I tried to date each child individually, personally, once a month, minimum. They could choose where we went out on our date, and I've got some wild stories about that. One of my youngest daughter wanted us to her favorite restaurant was a place called the Imperial House. And to her, that was an elegant place. And it is a nice restaurant. And so she dressed up in her best dress, long dress. It was, and she spent lots of time on her hair. And Dad and Jean went out to that restaurant. And the owner of the restaurant saw me and knows me, came over, sat down. And I proceeded to get into a theological discussion about the gospel of Christ with him. I don't believe the man is saved yet, but I took every opportunity to share my life and my beliefs and my faith in Christ with him. But the only thing that happened that night was that my daughter was offended. She was hurt because she said, "That man ruined our date, Dad." She's probably my most deeply spiritual girl to this day. So you say, what was it wrong to share the gospel of Christ with that man? And I really believe that I was not sensitive to the Spirit of God, to my child, during that date. I could have arranged another time with that man. I didn't. I was insensitive to my child, and I had to apologize for that. And I'll trust God that the time was profitable in apologizing, and the time was profitable for the restaurant owner. But I learned lessons about during these date times. And this does not cease. This business of being a father to your children does not cease when they leave your home. Kathy and Bernie and Rebecca live in Bismarck, North Dakota. If you've not looked at a map recently, that is a long ways from Florida. We are going to drive up there in a car, good Lord willing. We have a missionary journey planned on May 10th, approximately 19 days. We're going to stop at each of our children's homes. And along the way, we plan to do some praying and talking as a husband and wife about these next years that God would leave us here on this earth. We want to practice sharing our faith with waitresses and motel people along the way that we probably will never see again. We just have been praying for this trip. But anyway, we're going to visit them. But I've had three calls from Kathy in this last week. Kathy is a graduate of the Atlanta College of Art. She has a master's degree in education. Bernie, as I said, has a Ph.D. in theology from Emory University in Atlanta. And he's a very godly, quiet person. He's about 10 years older than my daughter. They really love each other. But Bernie's father, Vincent, the doctors felt like he possibly was being afflicted with Parkinson's disease. And so Kathy called me a week or so ago with a prayer request about that for her father-in-law. Also for some counsel about some plans they had this summer about going to Washington State to a wedding of a close friend from art college. And at the same time visiting Bernie's father's sister who lives in the state of Washington, who doesn't understand things very well sometimes as to why you change your plans. And she just needed some advice and counsel on what they should do, whether they should continue their plans to see a friend married and so on, or go to see Vincent, his father, in Virginia, and just to be with him. And so we have talked about three times over the last probably 10 days about this situation. He has been confirmed as a Parkinson disease possessor. And so the counsel and the advice and the principles, spiritual principles, keep on going. My daughter still looks to us for advice because she knows our life. She knows the way we live. And she values counsel, not just from us, but from others. And so the principles keep on building. There's a different structure to the counsel and to the imparting of spiritual principles at different times in your life. But it keeps on going. So we're looking forward to that trip to be with them. Now we're going to talk about the manner of this imparting of these spiritual principles. How do you do it? What's the how? Now I'll make a statement, and like all statements, unless they come directly from the Bible, there are probably some discrepancies in it. But basically speaking, under normal conditions, your children will eventually become what you are. Now that can be both exciting and horrifying. And that's why we must work on these three areas: the training of our children, what I've called the way, and what I've called being steadfast. Because if we understand what training is, and if we understand what it's meant in Acts 9:2 by the disciples being called the followers of the way, if we understand that, and if we're steadfast in being a follower of the way, I am the way. We heard that just this morning in the closing moments of the message. I am the way. And when we become a follower of the way, then we wish and desire and pray that God would make us like Christ and make us like His way. And so as we grow in that grace, and with a heart to train up a child in the way he should go, then I believe that we'll begin to see these spiritual principles that grip our lives being imparted into them, and they will in fact become what we are. And if we're willing to admit, in the next section we're going to talk a little bit about weaknesses, if we're willing to admit weaknesses, God, it's like the Passover. God will pass over those weaknesses if we're willing to confess them and to be open enough to work on them and to see them. I'm going to read a definition out of Webster's Dictionary, the collegiate version in 1952 when I was in college, because it's been changed over these years. I want to meet Webster someday. I believe he's a saved man, was, and I believe someday I'll meet him, because I just love his definitions on terminology that we would consider Christian terminology. It's just great. But the new Webster's books that have been revised, you know, are kind of washed down like so many things. But in this 52 version, his definition of training was to lead or direct the growth of, to lead or direct the growth of, to form by bending, pruning, etc. To form by bending, pruning, etc. To form by instruction, discipline, drill, education. To form by instruction, discipline, drill, education. To teach so as to be fitted, qualified, proficient, to make prepared for a test. If anything says it all, the last section was to teach so as to be fitted, qualified, proficient, to make prepared for a test. If anything says anything about training your children in the way they should go, that kind of does it all. Training is not just teaching. Training is leading, directing, those things which are mentioned in here, as well as teaching. Bending, pruning, they're such neat terms. The with him principle, which we've heard now twice, last night and this morning, take your children into the yard when you're pruning something and explain about pruning in the Christian life. I mean, how often have you done gardening with the kids and use the opportunity to talk to them and teach them spiritual principles? Not enough. I'm learning as I go along now that the children are just about out of the nest. And it's kind of interesting that our last one, David, is the least interested in spiritual things. Let's put it that way. David has not made his lordship decision. And if I had not gone 20 years myself without doing this, without turning everything that I could think of and understand and had possession of over to the Lord, 20 years went by in my life, and here I am when my son is less old than that, and I'm concerned about when he's going to decide to sell his farm and give it to the Lord. So my son and I are busy. We're busy learning to know each other as friends, not just a father and son at this point. While I'm talking about David, that's when he's ready to go to his senior prom with corsage in hand. Now, this picture doesn't show it, but he keeps his hair longer than we like. And that's, you know, kind of an interesting thing. So often we impose so much of our own standards on the children. I sat across from him at a restaurant the other night as he was reading the menu, and I looked at his hair, longer than I like it to be, but the part was as straight as the side of that screen. His hair was as clean and shiny as any. He takes wonderful care of it. He always looks immaculate, but it's longer than I like. And so that is one area that illustrates the principle that we go on in our life, is that winning the war is more important than winning the battle. And that is a battle. And I could win that battle by, for years, dragging him down to the barber and getting it cut off to the length that I like it. But that's a battle. And I do not wish to lose the war for the sake of winning that battle. And there have been other battles and wars in our... There is only one war, and that's the war to be a warrior for Jesus Christ. And I want our children to be that warrior, and I'm not about to lose skirmishes and lose the total war. Now, there are some things you need to take stands on, and I don't believe the length of the hair is one of them. We'll discuss in a moment another area that was a kind of a war zone in our life. But at any rate, David and I are becoming good friends. He works out at Nautilus every day. He's about an inch taller than I am and weighs considerably less, but he's built very well. He lifts weights. He plays baseball, and he was in the band all through high school and junior high school. He's very popular with the girls. He will not get serious about girls. He has not learned the sensitivity yet to gracefully tell them that he's not interested in being serious with them. And he drops them like hot potatoes, and it's an area we're working on. But he always has four or five girls at a time. Usually one of them is a favorite, but they usually don't last more than 2-3 weeks. Tonight is his another prom he's taking a girl to, who about 2 weeks ago became serious to him. And then he had to fight off this problem with taking her to the prom and spending all this money on her when she wants to be serious and he doesn't want to be. And he's got a car he's paying for. And all these things are causing great strife in his life. He knows he has to take her to the prom because he told her he would. He's even rented his tux. But he hates to spend money for dinner and the prom and the tux when she's so interested in being serious. And these are really big problems for him. I spent almost as much time working with him on this problem before I came here this past week than I did working on this workshop this past week. I mean, that's how serious it is to him. But Dave is coming along, and I'm pleased with him. But one day he came into my office. I have a double examining lane, a chair here and then a little wall partition and another chair, and then it runs out across the room. And I had a patient in each one. I was working in one chair, and he came in to switch cars so we could have one of our cars worked on. And he roared across the room, picked up the keys off my desk where he knew I had them. And on the way back across, he came over to me at the chair and kissed me and then left. And both of these were women patients. And they didn't believe that. Here's a, well, at the time he was 17, but about the same size as he is now, walking over and kissing me on the lips and then leaving. Now, we believe in physical contact. My son kisses me and my wife at the beginning and the end of the day and when he gets home from work and any time he's been gone for a significant amount of time. He kisses my wife 5 or 6 times in quick succession as a habit that he began when he was 5 years old, and she went away one time for 4 days and she said, "I need kisses for 4 days," and he gave her these quick little pecks. To this day he still kisses her. I only get one, but he gives her 4 or 5 or 6, I can't quite count them, they're too fast. But we believe in physical contact with our children. We love and hug them, including my son, and embracing him will be a neat thing tomorrow when I get home at the airport, giving my son a hug. But that's part of the way and part of the training that you want your children to be loving. And you want him to love, I want him to love his wife someday. And the only way he's going to find that out is to see how I love my wife. If he wants to know about loving wives, what I believe is loving a wife, and he's going to watch me because I'm the closest one to him. And so I want him to model us. And what that brings us to is the modeling and the method. And those verses in Colossians, as you know, are the few verses that are stated in the hospital. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, be in subjection to your husband. Children, obey your parents. Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger. Exasperate them, one of the versions said. But the model that our children have in our homes is the relationship, generally speaking, that a husband and wife have for each other. Now, a little NB up in the corner there is a notation that a college professor gave me in 1954. A PhD in chemistry, means nota bien, of great note, and means very important. And whenever I take notes at a seminar or church, and there's something I think is important, I put a little NB beside it, and that reminds me as I look through my notes that that is very important. It was either important to the lecturer or important to me as I heard it, and I do that in my Bible studies, and I do it all the time, but that's just to let you know that I believe that husband and wife relationship is the method and the model, generally speaking, in Christian homes for the children to get their spiritual principles. They have got to watch us in our walk with God, in our relationship to each other. My wife and I seldom, without fail, have a date every week, at least once a week. Now, a date for us consists sometimes of going to Burger King and having a Coke and just sitting there. We go at an off time when nobody's there and we can sit for a few hours and not bother anybody. There are sometimes our dates are short. Sometimes they're a walk in a neighborhood. But from an early age, our children knew that they were important. Our children at one point in time saved their nickels, dimes, and quarters from babysitting and whatever. And on our anniversary in June, they gave us a little box of money with a card that said, "Happy anniversary, this is for 3 dates." And that was their way of telling us they approved of our dates. And I'm still falling in love with my wife. I'm still learning about that. I'm learning to, I'm a student of hers, and she's a student of me. We were talking the other day, we said, you know, we don't seem to argue as much anymore. I said, either we're tired of fighting, or we've learned something about each other, or something is changing in our lives. You know, it almost concerned me at first that we may weren't arguing enough. You know, we used to argue a good bit, and arguing wasn't very pleasant, but making up was wonderful, and we really enjoyed those times. But even the solving of arguments has been a ministry in our home. Now, we have an open home. We have usually have people living with us, single girls, sometimes single guys, sometimes divorced women, sometimes We've had one pregnant girl out of wedlock who lived with us through her birth of her child. We've had couples. One time we had two couples and two singles in our home at one time living with us. We believe that there's a lot can be learned by sharing your home with other people. We do not go out and seek these people. God brings people to us. Currently, we have, in addition to my son, we have a single girl who's 30 years old. We have a divorced woman who's waiting for her home to be finished, just moved here from Mississippi. She's about 58. We had a girl who was a school teacher, 25 years old, living with us. And she was rooming in with my middle girl, Louise. And every time she was kind of kicked out of her home, she was from a split home, her mother was remarried, and her father was off somewhere. And the new father didn't like her dogs. So he said, either the dogs go or you both go. So she decided she liked the dogs, so she moved in with us. She was involved in one of our Bible studies, and she moved in with us, dogs and all. And I don't really hate dogs. But it says in Genesis that God gave us dominion over the animals. And when they run our lives, then I don't appreciate dogs. And so often dogs are like people, and you've got to spend time with them. I don't really have time to spend with the dogs. And we have a cat, because you don't need to spend time with a cat. They do what they want to do anyway. So it is kind of nice to have pets around. But at any rate, we took her, dogs and all, and she came in our home for a period of 2 years. And met her husband there at a Bible study and is now in Charleston in the Navy. He's a naval officer like our Louise that she roomed with. Her husband is a naval officer also. At any rate, when we would argue, my wife and me, Pat would leave the room. We'd see her sneaking off. So we'd drag her back in and I'd say, you're going to sit right there until we finish our argument, until we resolve our conflicts. When you get married, are you going to run off somewhere and hide when you and your husband argue? So we said, you need to learn how husbands and wives resolve their conflicts. So she sat through enough conflicts that she no longer left. And we trust, and we do keep touch with her. In fact, our Louise and her husband Mark are now living in Charleston also, same town, both still in the Navy. And they get together very frequently now, and we're able to keep a closer touch on people that we've had some influence in our life. But even solving of arguments can be a blessing. Not to avoid weaknesses. I saw it in somebody's book, to be transparent. Let your kids, let the people around you see some of your weaknesses. I mean, we really have a lot of them, and I don't want to belabor the weaknesses. And you want to, emphasize strengths, but please be honest with your family and with your children. Don't profess or pretend to be what you aren't. Let them know who you are. When you have a weakness, admit it and ask for prayer. Involve your family in your weaknesses, in the solution of them, the resolution of them. The single parent, that's a whole different workshop. I believe that, especially in the area of a woman, single parent, raising children, that God, if the single parent will allow this, that God becomes the other parent. That God takes her husband's role and works through that single woman. I believe that, and I believe that if the faith can be mustered by the gal, that's the way God will show himself real, is in raising of the whatever children she has to raise in that single condition. That if his grace is not sufficient, then we're all in trouble. We really are. So I won't go into a whole workshop topic on a single parent, but I don't want single parents to feel like they've got all the problems in the world. I'm not a single parent, and I've got a few. And I'll be glad to share my problems with anybody. I try not to share any but those that I believe God would have me share. This is Gene and Tim, my last one married. They live in Cleveland, Ohio. He's working on the space station up there for NASA. He's an elder in a Lutheran church. He was involved with Navigator Ministry at Georgia Tech. That's where he met Jean when she was going to art school there in Atlanta. Two girls from art school, two artists. And then my son's favorite daughter is Louise, the middle one. Now, Louise was a klutz. She's doing better because she's going to aerobics now and she's getting more coordination. But she tried ballet and failed. The teacher didn't want her back. She tried piano lessons, but her fingers were too short. She was a good student, and she's the most full of joy. Not Jean here, but Louise. But anyway, my son was Louise is and was his favorite sister. He would refer to his three sisters when they said, "Do you have any sisters?" He'd say, "Yes, I have three of them. Two of them are artists, and one's a nothing." That's what he used to say. One's a nothing. Well, this is one of the artists. This is one of the nothing. But he didn't say that to have any disrespect for her. He was just identifying, you know, what his appearance of their strengths were. So Jean is an artist. She took 10 years of ballet. We were trained in the art of taxi cab driving for 10 years. You know, it's interesting. They started 5, and she went till she was 15. Made her own decision after a trip to New York that she didn't want to pursue ballet because it was too hard. She could not follow Christ as she wanted to, and she was sure that she'd have a difficult time making it. Her knees were giving out on her. Her knees are still very painful, and we wonder how wise it was. But ballet gave her something to excel in. She was not a good student. She became a good student in high school, but she was a poor reader. We learned about auditory problems of hearing and connecting what she saw and heard. We trained her with ourselves and some friends. She then ended up being honor society in high school. But at the time when she went into ballet, she was had a very low image of herself. And ballet gave her poise and grace, and she loved it, and we loved doing it. But there was a lot of driving in the automobile, and so Jean came up with some things about Tim that emphasize a little bit about the model. Tim is, you see by his prominent jaw, he's strong. He has a lot of very good qualities, but he's very stubborn. And his father was a Lutheran minister. He's in a church in Cleveland that is pastored by a former Navigator staff man that I knew personally for 5 or 6 years. And he's up there kind of learning about discipling people in a church. And like I say, he's on the board of elders, but he's kind of stubborn. And Jean is a very simplistic little girl. She's still my little girl. But at any rate, Tim exasperates her sometimes. And so on her own and through the telephone conversation about a month ago, she shared with my wife that she has a notebook on her husband, and she's listing all of his strong points. Everything positive that she can see in her husband. And she's got many pages already. No bad points, just strong points. And she's a very disciplined girl, and you have to be that to be in ballet. You know, the hair, the clothes, everything. We made her take everything. You know, we didn't remind her of anything. If she went there and didn't have whatever she needed, she was in trouble with the teacher, not with us. So she learned discipline through ballet. But anyway, when he shows a bad point to her, she is disciplined enough that the minute she is alone, she goes to her notebook and prays over the strong points and praises God for them. And she is, it says in Corinthians about deadening by discipline, deadening the bad habits in your life by discipline. And that's what she's doing. By discipline, she's deadening her critical spirit of the bad things she sees in her husband that annoy her. And so, you know, we didn't overtly train her that way, but she saw us working at our relationship. And this is how the creative God of the universe has used his creativity in her to help her with a problem. Now, we'll share that. I've shared that with you, and we're sharing that with other people who are having problems with their husbands or their wives and doing little things. I had a gal from the workshop last night whose husband gives her some problems, and that I passed it on to her a little more detailed privately afterwards because she was having these problems. So Gene and Tim have helped us in the area of learning about the model that we have in our home. Convictions. We talked a little bit about convictions earlier. Please work on your own convictions about as many subjects in living this life that we live here on this earth as you can. Work on convictions. Know why you believe what you believe. Be ready always to answer any man who asks you a reason for the hope that's in you. Have reasons why you believe. Now, we cannot, there comes a time somewhere in our child's lives when they must form their own convictions. They cannot any longer live on our convictions. But if we don't have any convictions, they are mishy-mashy all over the map as well. They need to have your convictions until a certain age, and then they need to form their own convictions. Now, part of the forming of these convictions, we put up some house rules when we were starting to raise our kids as far as disciplining them. We disciplined them for three areas: disobedience, disrespect, and dishonesty. Those three things we said we will not tolerate without some type of punishment. Disobedience to us, disrespect to us or to anybody, dishonesty in any way that we could find it. If they did one of those three areas and it was a very positive offense, and we'd made sure and checked it out and were positive of the offense, we then meted out some type of punishment, hopefully commensurate with the offense. We disobeyed some of the teachings. We used our hands. I went to a seminar where you're supposed to use a spoon or a rod or whatever, and I thought, well, maybe that's true. I did notice that. And yes, it seems logical. If you spank with your hand and love with your hand, they get confused. But when I got to that point, I gathered the kids. I said, been to the Gothard seminar too. I've come to realize, those are one of his favorite terms, I've come to realize that we've been possibly inflicting you with pain the wrong way, that we should not be using our hands because we don't want to confuse you about this is where, you know, we reach out to you one hand and we don't want you to back up because you think we're going to strike you on the bottom. So maybe we ought to switch to the little switch. Well, they voted 4-0 to stay with the hand. There's nothing worse when our kids were growing up than a daddy spank. I didn't spank very often, but when I did, it was a memorable event. They hated daddy spanks. If they even thought there was a daddy spank, they would break into tears. I don't believe any of them ever felt that I didn't love them, that I wasn't doing it because it was the right thing to do. And so I will not take a stand on the instrument. I do know this, that if you do not have good self-control, that you're more apt to hurt them in anger using your hand because you act too swiftly. You've got your hand with you. If you have to go get the switch or the wooden spoon or whatever, you'll cool down a little bit. So you need to know yourselves too. I'm not that quick to anger. And so perhaps that's why it worked out in our life. But, you know, try to read yourself and ask your wife honestly to assess who you are and where you're going. But anyway, we had those house rules. The area of speech. My son David taught me something about speech at his band and weekly visit to Godfather's Pizza after the football game. The woman band director came up to Dave and said, Dave, apparently there was a lot of swearing going on that particular evening. And she said, Dave, I notice you don't swear. Well, I was, you know, he was telling me this. I said, I was waiting for his sound theological answer and his sharing the gospel with his band director. And he said, there's no point in it. That's what he told her. There's no point in it. I said, well, that's one way of saying it. The more I thought about that, Dave has seen in our house that there isn't any point in it. Swearing doesn't communicate very much except a poor vocabulary. And so in his estimation of our home life and the fact that we don't swear and we get things accomplished, there was no point in swearing. And so he's not been a curser. And I thank the Lord for that. I've learned more, I know, than our children have about the various things, the importance of the speech in your home. Let it be with grace, seasoned with salt. Colossians 4:6. That you, speak gently. And the other day I was talking to my son rather sternly, and when I left, he told her, you know, Dad was yelling at me. And she had heard it. You know, she said, well, he wasn't yelling at you. And he said, he was yelling at me with that quiet tone of voice that he has. You know, and so he even knows when I'm yelling at him, even when it's not loud. Speech and the way you communicate to your children is very important. Dating, another whole subject. Let me say this. The girls accepted Bill Gothard's premise that they ought to clear their dates through their father. If you haven't been to the seminar, he suggests simply a voluntary program where the girl decides on her own that she's going to be protected by her father from bad dates by letting all boys who want to date them contact me for permission for a date. And it's a big responsibility. I went there to the seminar too, and I thought it was kind of neat, but then as I thought of the implications, I wasn't too sure I wanted to do that. But we've learned a lot through that process. My daughter in art school in Atlanta was accosted by a black man on the street at a bus stop who wanted to take her out, and he gave her a really rough time about, I bet you don't date black girls. And she remembered a black missionary who'd come through our town to go to Disney World and stayed with us, and she took him to Disney World to kind of show him around, and she said to this guy, oh, yes, I have. You know, and he said, I bet you've never dated a black. So she inserted that event in her life as a way to get him off her back. But finally, when he pursued her even more until the bus came, she said, well, I don't date anybody unless my father okays it. And she gave him my name and telephone number and quickly went back to her apartment and called me and said, Dad, you may get a request for a date from a rather ominous, harsh-sounding black man from Atlanta. And if you do, please know that I would like you to share the gospel with him. That was what it turned out. Well, he never called. And perhaps I prayed hard enough that he didn't. But there's been just a lot of interesting things occur in our lives out of this dating process. But our three girls did not go to their senior proms. They're all married to guys that love them very much. And they met them in many different ways. Kathy's husband was taught a course in English literature at her art school while he was working on his PhD at Emory. And that's how she met him, as a teacher, one of her teachers. Jean met her husband Tim at a Bible study in Atlanta with the Navigators. And Louise met her husband Mark at our house in a Bible study while he was there at Nuclear Power School in Orlando. So they didn't need to go to the prom or do anything to meet their husbands. God is faithful to bring people into your lives. But dating in my son's area has been a different story. Dave went to the seminar and doesn't say anything about what the boys ought to do about clearing their dates. So he's been faithful to clear his dates through the girl's father. And that's kind of an interesting twist on it I hadn't heard at the seminar. But he goes over and meets the parents when he sees a girl he likes, and he hangs around their house for a while. And usually that ends the relationship because he sees things in the house that he doesn't like. the parents are harsh or they're this or they're that, and so he doesn't want to hassle, so he moves on. But he dates a lot of girls, and he has a lot of girl friends. He talks to girls all the time on the telephone, and they counsel with him. I found that girls in high school now do not have boys that'll talk to them like brothers. They have girls that'll talk to them like sisters, but not boys, and they don't get that input. Boys all want to be dating. Boys are interested in sex and whatever, and they're not interested just talking to people for friends. And so he's got a lot of girl friends that he spends time with on the phone, that he visits and talks to, and is interested in their lives. So he's kind of an interesting fellow in that regard. But dating has got to be a conviction of your own. What do you think about it? When's it too early? You know, I had a friend that said his daughters could date as soon as they were 30 years old. That was when they could have their first date. Well, he's since came down to 17. It's been a rapid descent from 30 when his first thoughts came to him. But I won't tell you anything except that be sensitive to the Spirit of God. Don't break the child's spirit. Don't interfere with your relationship with them. Now, don't let them do dumb things. You know, I have put my foot down. My daughter wanted to, she had a guy she was very interested in. She wanted to fly up from Atlanta and meet his parents in Virginia or someplace, and then drive down to Florida. And they were going to stop, and they were going to have separate rooms in the motel and all this stuff. And I said, you know, Kathy, I don't mind you going meeting his parents. And the guy had been in our house for 6 months in Bible study, and he loved the Lord, and he was a fine young guy. I said, I don't think it's good to have people see you as singles stopping in a motel, even if you have a separate room. I just don't think it's a good temptation. I'm saying no. If you want to disobey me, that's up to you. Well, she had him call me, and we had a good talk, and they didn't do it. And, months later, they broke up in their relationship. He's still walking with the Lord, and she still is too. But she came to me and she said, Dad, just wanted to thank you and tell you that you were right, and I'm sorry that I pushed you to that point, and that he was not the one for me to be doing anything like that. So each child is different, each situation is different, and just rely on the grace of God. Now, last little section deals with our homes, and that's probably what we consider, if not the most important, one of the most important aspects is the atmosphere of your home. Your home should be a refuge. It should be a place where you can get away from the pressures of the world. Be not conformed to the world. Be transformed. And that should be a place where transformation can take place. And gals, let me lay this one on you, like it or not. Generally speaking, the homemaker sets the atmosphere in the home. My wife has complete control over whether there's hostility going on there or there isn't. When I walk in from the office and I have need of refuge, she knows that she can either hop on me with everything she's thought about that day that's pressing her, or she can wait till I can enjoy the refuge for a little bit, and then after I've eaten and we're just sitting there a little while, that she can insert those things, what she needs to share with me. She's learned that over bitter trials of hitting me as I walk through the door and seeing me just kind of come apart. And it's, so she knows she sets the atmosphere. And she'll tell you that if you ask her, that it's up to her to set the tone of the home. It's up to me to be the head of it. But she sets the tone. Our home, we try to have one as a home of encouragement and happiness. We like people to have fun there. We don't like anybody to feel like that they're not welcome in our home. Louise and Mark are now in their own home in Charleston, their first house. They bought a house. The savings and loan in them have bought a house. I think the savings and loan owns a lot more of it than they do. But the picture above their heads was a wedding present from our oldest daughter. It's a watercolor of a barn, and they're kind of into antiques and things like that. And so she is a joy, and he is just a strong, godly man, and I really appreciate his walk with God. Now, I think that all she learned, she lived in our home until she got married, and then she went to college from the home, commuted to University of Central Florida, got her AA degree, and right after that she got married. And we've seen a lot of her, more than I thought we would when she went all the way to Connecticut, but her home is a place of refuge. Now, I said hospitality in that other list. The goal for our children is that our home is not the only place to live, but it's the kind of place to live. We want them to set their homes up so that they model the type of atmosphere that they lived in our home. You'll find something, well, I may touch on some toes, or that we have ashtrays almost in every room, and we don't smoke, none of us do. But I don't want one person to come in our home and feel uncomfortable so that they'll never come back. I want our home to be a place of refuge for the weary. We have a gal that came to our Bible study from across the street, retired folks. They both received Christ in our house after studying there for 6 or 7 months. They were active in their church back in New York State before they came to Florida. And they thought they were Christians, and they found out they weren't. Her husband died 2 or 3 years ago of cancer. She is still a close friend of my wife. She is now suffering greatly from cancer. She's had one breast removed. She's had several other operations. She's been on chemotherapy almost steadily for a year and a half. She has no hair left. She still smokes. And we had somebody, we had a meeting over there to introduce her to a friend that she loves very much, who's a missionary, to see him. And we brought her ashtray, and she sat there and smoked. And a couple of my Christian friends criticized me for letting her smoke. I explained to her, to them, what was going on in her life. I went over and greeted her that night, and she showed me a few more lumps that she's popped up. Now, she could have quit a year ago, and it wouldn't have made any difference. She's got cancer. God's the only one that can make any difference. She needs to have every bit of comfort during these last days that she can have. She doesn't need me to be telling her to stop smoking, and I'm not going to, if you want to smoke, you go outside. She doesn't need that. Stopping right now is not going to cure her cancer. She's trusting God each day for the strength and what to do in the fighting of this disease. She's asked God to heal her, obviously. He hasn't chosen to do that. There is one ultimate healing that none of us want, and that's the healing we go home to be with the Lord. That's the final healing. And we want to tell God what kind of healing we want. You know, we want an instantaneous, want these lumps to dissolve. You know, we want all this to go on like we want it to happen, and not, so she knows all about the different kinds of healing. But we want our home to be a home of hospitality and happiness and encouragement. Now, it's not always that way. And, you know, you can welcome to come. If you come to Orlando, give us a call, and we'll be, if we have a place for you. There are times when our 6 bedrooms are filled. There are times when there are people sleeping on sofas. Normally we have a place. But that shows you the challenge that I have, is my son posing there in his high chair. My thoughts were on this workshop, how to raise children, and then there was David. David gives us a challenge every day, and I believe in my heart of hearts that's why right now he's the only one in the house. We can give him attention and spend the kind of time that a father and son need to spend. And God's been very gracious to me to give me more time than I used to have. I used to have involved with more individual people than I am right now. Until I go to the grave, I'm going to be involved in disciple making. I'm going to be involved in people's lives. We have, right now my wife and I are working with 4 couples and 3 singles. She works with 3 single gals. I work with 1 single guy. And those are major outputs inputs to our lives, those couples and those singles. And we have Bible studies, we have a lot of other little things going on around those. And you heard this morning the With Him principle. One of the couples I teach Sunday school with, he's involved in the preparations of my Sunday school. He's involved in, he sits there while I teach, and I sit there while he teaches. And we talk about these things. We do a lot of things together. And they become almost like children to us, another set of children, even though they have three young little girls of their own to raise. But we're working with them and imparting spiritual principles to them while we continue to do this with our own children. And so God has blessed us, and I know that's our gang at Christmas again, all of us assembled. And in case you're wondering, how did you take the picture? The girl that lives with us took the picture. We didn't have a tripod, and we didn't know how we could get her in the picture too, but she's part of our family. But she took the picture of our gang assembled. But I want to just leave this thought with you. You could go to all three of these seminars that are going on, finishing up right now, and you'd hear lots of things like you heard in here today and different approaches. But trusting in God to do this with you is the only way. I believe that every generation has felt like it was impossible to raise children because of the times. I don't think, you know, it looks to me at age 50 like I wouldn't want to raise them now, but it looked to my parents when I was 25 and they were 50 that it was, you know, I wouldn't want to raise my children now. And I'm sure this backed off all through the generations. So God has put this whole process in motion. And I believe that only through your lives committed to Him totally, your forming of your own personal convictions, your sensitivity to God, the Holy Spirit in you, what you've learned about the love of Christ coming out through you is the only way you got half a chance of doing it. And then you get the new generation, the grandparents like us, imparting principles into grandchildren, and it just keeps going on and on. If you don't have enough children, adopt some in the block, some in the church. There's kids around that you can help to grow up in the Lord. Let me say a prayer, and then if you want to hang around a little bit. Father, I do thank you for the opportunity to be here in California. Right now, it seems like a long way from home. And I thank you for refreshing my body to the point of these workshops, and ask for further grace personally for the rest of the day. And I thank you for each person here that's come on faith to learn something. And I trust you will have imparted some things that they can adopt to their own lives in their raising of children and to their advice and counsel to others raising children. I thank you for our children and for the joy and the hard times that they've been. Each has produced its own effect in my life and helped to make me more like you. So I thank you now and praise your name in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.